Lafferty on behalf of the Philadelphia Stock Exchange and the individual defendants below. I rise to introduce my co-counsel, who's at the counsel table, Stephen Kastenberg from the Ballard Spahr firm in Philadelphia.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jessica Zeldin from Rosenthal, Monheit and Gottes in Wilmington on behalf of appellee Chuck Ginsburg. I also rise to make a number of introductions. My co-counsel, Lauren Deutsch, and Robin Switzenbaum, both from Berger and Montague in Philadelphia. Mr. Deutsch will be making today's arguments. Thank you.
Welcome.
Good morning. It's Paul Lockwood from Skadden Arps, and I'm here on behalf of Merrill Lynch. I'm also going to be speaking today for five other institutional investor defendants in the case, and they each have their own lawyers here, both from New York and Delaware. It's a large group, so I'm not going to introduce each one of them. Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Bob Val here on behalf of the nine merits-based appellants. I rise to introduce my co-counsel, Lynanne Westcott.
Welcome.
And Stephen Miro, and I'll be making the argument this morning. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Maimon of Edwards Angel Palmer and Dodge, representing the class certification appellants. May it please the Court. My clients are challenging only the class definition aspect of the settlement, not the settlement in total. This action involves a series of transactions that extended from April 20th of 2005 until August 16th of 2005, which resulted in control of the Philadelphia Stock Exchange being transferred from the public stockholders of Philex to six large financial institutions. The last act challenged in this action was disclosed in a press release dated August 16, 2005, which we contend is when the class period should end. And the transfer of control violated the Philex Charter. Notwithstanding the fact that the wrongdoing ended on August 16, 2005, the class period being challenged here extends to June 20th of 2007, almost 2 years after the wrongdoing. All of my clients' challenges to this settlement arise from the decision of the Court of Chancery and Sun States, which held two things. First, it held that a charter violation claim attaches to the stock. Secondly, it held that acquirer of the stock after the violation also acquires the charter violation claim. According to Sun States, it does not matter if the acquirer was injured by the misconduct, and it does not matter if the acquirer had knowledge of the violation before the acquisition. All that matters is that the acquirer purchased stock. And if the acquirer purchased stock, according to Sun States, the acquirer could raise a charter violation claim, although the wrongdoing predated the acquisition. My client's position is this aspect of Sun States' holdings should be rejected, and rejected for two primary reasons. First, there is no reason to disregard the well-established rule that a stockholder must hold stock at the time of the wrongdoing to assert a claim. This is the rule in direct actions. This is the rule in derivative actions. The Chancellor held, and we agree, that this is a direct action. Therefore, it's clear under general Delaware law, well-established law, that a stockholder must hold stock at the time of the wrongdoing to assert a claim. Sun States is contrary to this. The second point on why Sun States should be rejected is because it simply violates Delaware public policy. Delaware public policy does not permit the purchase of a claim. So in this case, the stockholders, because of an August 16th press release, had knowledge of wrongdoing. Purchase stock, and now claim under Sun State's claim they could assert a claim. This is a purchase of a claim, and this violates well-established public policy.
Mr. Maimon, yes. I think I would find it easier to follow your argument if I knew what your bottom line was.
Well, my bottom line
is your bottom line that the court, A, should not have certified the class that it certified, or B, if it did certify the class, it should have broken the class up into subclasses, or is there a C or a D?
I wish there was a C or a D, Your Honor, but I'm stuck with A and B. My bottom line is the class is certified incorrectly. It's too large. The class should be certified from April 20th, 2005 through August 16th, 2005. And the transferees, which my friends over at Appellee's table like to use the word transferees, including the transferees that acquired stock during that time period. The class, rather than ending on August 16th, 2005, ends on June 20th, 2007. And the reason it ends 2 years after the wrongdoing is because my friends at Appellee's table say that Sun States creates a situation where claims for charter violations continually move forward with the transfer of stock to other individuals after the wrongdoing. In the alternative, if this court believes that the class was defined properly, as an alternative argument, my clients contend that subclasses should exist and that the subclasses should have separate representation. If this court rejects this aspect of SunState, then, from my client's point of view, the legal issues raised by my clients in this appeal vanish, and the class should be redefined to include only injured Philex stockholders. Such holding should be embraced by all parties to this appeal because, from my client's point of view, the class will consist of only injured stockholders as my clients desire. Those are stockholders between April 20th, 2005 and August 16th, 2005.
August 16th, 2005 being the date of what?
It was the date that a press release was issued which provided that transactions were taking place with several of the six financial institutions which essentially shifted control of Philex.
It was an announcement that the transactions were going to take place or that they had taken place?
I believe it had taken place. And the press release can be found at A130 in the appendix, if you're on a case to read the press release. As I said, my clients will be satisfied because the class would only consist of injured stockholders. I believe defendants should be satisfied because they will receive releases from the injured stockholders, meaning my clients, and the court would hold that there are no other claims that could be asserted against defendants. So defendants will be free of all liability. And I believe class plaintiffs should be satisfied because the settlement could be approved substantially on the same terms as currently exist, with a redefinition of the class to satisfy my clients, but with a holding that SunState was wrongly decided and that this concept of a claim attaching to stock is an incorrect concept under Delaware law. If, however, this court does not reject SunState, then two legal issues arise from SunState. The first issue is whether stockholders that were not injured by wrongful conduct should be permitted to collect money damages in a class action settlement. The second issue is whether a stockholder may be stripped of the right to challenge an alleged violation of a charter through a class action settlement absent the stockholder's approval. If this court holds that the answer to either of these two questions is no, then the class certification definition of the Court of Chancery should be reversed. In connection with the first issue, in my client's opening brief, my clients asked the appellees one simple question. What was the injury suffered by the members of the class that acquired shares after August 16, 2005, after the press release which disclosed the transactions that were challenged? It should also be noted that since the press release disclosed the transactions, all subsequent purchasers of stock had knowledge of the wrongdoing. In 87 pages of answering brief, appellees cannot identify a single injury. Appellees spoke in terms of giving up an interest. They spoke of giving up a claim to enforce the Philex charter, but they cannot identify a single injury. Indeed, Justice Berger asked this very question during the previous argument, and class plaintiffs simply failed to identify an injury, and this could be found at pages 23 and 24 of the transcript. Class plaintiff implied that there was an ongoing breach, but never identified an injury suffered by the members of the class that acquired a Philex stock after the wrongdoing and with knowledge of the wrongdoing. Simply stated, because stockholders that acquired stock after the wrongful conduct were not injured, such stockholders should not be members of the class and should not collect money damages. And these arguments are brought out more fully in our opening brief at 22 through 24, our reply brief through 10, 11, and in this court's decision in Witt Capital, cited therein. In connection with the second issue, class plaintiff is attempting to settle void acts, acts that are legal nullities, and acts that cannot be settled without unanimous stockholder approval. Specifically, because of the structure of a corporation, the separation of ownership and management, stockholders have certain protections. One protection for stockholders is the provisions of a charter. Contractual rights between and among the state, the corporation, and the stockholders. And those provisions cannot be violated. For almost 100 years, stockholders have taken comfort in the law of this state that, one, actions that violate the charter are void, not voidable, but void, legal nullities. And two, that to resurrect such actions, unanimous stockholder approval is required.
This is an argument that wasn't raised below, isn't that correct?
I believe it was raised below in connection with the challenge of the theories were raised below in connection with the challenge of the class definition, but it wasn't brought out in this way. But I think conceptually it was raised below.
I'm not sure what you just said, but can you give me a record reference to where this issue was preserved?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry. There was a direct challenge, I believe, at A289, and the challenge of the concepts were raised below, dealing with the definition of the class at A295, A301, A305, A334 through 35, A337, A338, A339, A349, A418, and A430 through 431. And I believe the objectors below challenged the concepts that I'm raising here, but not these specific arguments. But I believe that these specific arguments are appropriate here because in our opening brief, we asked a very simple question, what was the injury? In their answering brief, they said, well, there really was no injury because we can't identify one. But our position is based upon this concept of sun states, that there is a continuing wrong based upon a charter violation. And in the reply brief, my argument is, well, if that's what you're basing this class definition upon, then your basis is wrong because you can't settle those types of claims in a class action for damages in a non-opt-out class. Because every stockholder is entitled to enforce the charter and to allege claims that stockholder believes violated the charter.
You just referred to a class action for damages. This is a class action for equitable relief, isn't it?
Well, it is a class action for equitable relief in connection with my clients believe that the challenge transactions are void and therefore should be invalidated or are invalid to begin with. The settlement is for damages, and make no mistake about that. People are contributing money, and people are giving back stock. And that money and that stock is creating a settlement pool, which is a damages settlement pool. And those damages are being distributed to the members of the class. There's no transaction is being invalidated. Unlike Nottingham Partners, which my friend cited during the last argument, Nottingham Partners was a settlement of a charter violation. But Nottingham Partners was different than this case. Nottingham Partners did not involve monetary damages. Nottingham Partners involved the invalidation of the challenge transaction. In fact, the court stated that it was a complete victory by plaintiff. So when my friends get up and say that this is really injunctive relief, it's not. The settlement is clear. The settlement involves monetary damages, which is being paid out to a class. No transaction, as far as I can tell, or no transaction challenged by my clients, is being invalidated.
Isn't that an overstatement? I thought the settlement was a return of some 55,000 shares plus $17 million in money damages. And if the value of the shares is monetized by whatever measure is set forth in the record, the $17 million is a minor fraction of that value.
But, Your Honor, no transaction is being invalidated. There's a return of stock as part of a settlement.
Well, nothing is being invalidated in a settlement, but the claim was one that would have required an invalidation. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So how is this case different from Nottingham Partners in that respect?
Because Nottingham Partners, the challenge transactions were invalidated in the settlement. The defendants agreed to invalidate the transactions being challenged by the plaintiffs. If Your Honor reads Nottingham Partners at...
I'm sorry, that's the distinction on which this case turns?
That's one of the distinctions on
that
which...
That the parties in the Nottingham settlement agreed that the charter amendment would be undone.
Correct.
And didn't that happen here, too, at least to the extent of the 55,000 shares?
But it didn't bring the six institutional investors down to the prescribed level set forth in the charter. If my friends in the settlement invalidated the challenge transactions in total, then Nottingham Partners would apply, and frankly, I wouldn't be here today. But they're giving back a fraction of the stock. They're not invalidating the underlying transactions. They're still
in
violation.
Partial versus full invalidation, is that the distinction?
If you want to call the return of 55, million shares, I'm sorry, 1,000 shares, I'm sorry, I lost track of the number. If you want a partial return of the stock, if you want to call that a partial invalidation, but I don't think it is, it's a contribution to a settlement fund for damages, along with the $17 million.
But those are the words that you're putting on the transaction. I mean, you're giving it a little characterization there as damages in order to make a legal argument. But the shares were being returned in kind.
Well, the shares were being returned, Your Honor, but not a sufficient amount of shares to remedy the Twitter violation.
But it wasn't the dollar value of the shares that was being put into a money pot along with $17 million. It was the shares.
Correct, right? Your Honor, but not a sufficient number of shares to remedy the charter violation. They didn't invalidate the transactions as they should have.
All right.
The situation here is analogous to a very simple factual situation. It's by analogy. This situation is the same as an action commenced by two plaintiffs alleging a breach of contract and seeking specific performance of that contract. And where one plaintiff settles for damages, in contrast to Pacific Performance, and imposes the settlement upon the other plaintiff, this case says that one plaintiff can impose a settlement upon another plaintiff in connection with a contract violation. That's what's happening here. There are stockholders that have been harmed by this charter violation, and this settlement is stripping them of their rights. Indeed, to adopt Appellee's view would turn Delaware law on its head, because such view would permit one stockholder to commence an action to enforce a charter provision and permit such single stockholder to settle the action for all stockholders without unanimous stockholder approval. This is what's happening here, and this completely undercuts the unanimous stockholder approval requirement.
Just to make sure that I'm clear on this, I understand that you would like the class period to be redefined and made less encompassing, and that in the alternative you would like there to be subclasses established. What if neither one of those goals are achieved? Are you then still willing to support the settlement, or are you opposing any settlement at that point?
No, we're willing to, and our position is we will support the settlement and we'll try to deal with our issues in the allocation process, although I don't think the allocation process could satisfactorily deal with our issues. We believe, as we discussed during the last argument, that there was a harm to my clients by permitting uninjured stockholders to be members of the class. And to have them participate in the allocation process is a harm to my clients as well. But we will, if we do not receive the relief we seek here, we will support the settlement and deal with allocation, and we'll probably be back here in connection with the allocation decision.
You say it's a harm to have persons that you contend suffered no harm participate in the allocation process. Why is it a harm? And if it is a harm, isn't it a theoretical harm? That is one that, as a practical matter, can be remedied in the allocation process itself.
My view is twofold. The fact that I'm standing here today and have to argue these issues and that the allocation didn't take place before final judgment is a situation created by appellants, which causes me to actually deal with this issue now, which is a harm to my clients because they don't know what they're going to get in the allocation.
Well,
and
what is the harm to your clients if they have to pay your fee to stand up here and argue? I mean, what is the
There's uncertainty. My clients have no idea what they're going to receive in connection with the settlement.
So is it your position that the court erred by not requiring the allocation formula or whatever it is to be determined up front and made part of the settlement?
It would have been better that way so we could understand what the level of harm
is. But you're not arguing that that was an error as a matter of law, correct?
We're not arguing that here.
Okay. There was discretion to
yes.
do that or not to do that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
I believe my time's up, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court. Again, Bob Vell here on behalf of the nine merits appellants. Good morning, Your Honors. You have before you an unprecedented situation. At the settlement hearing below, fully 50% of the shares in the settlement class objected to the proposed settlement. Never before has our Court of Chancery seen such a flood of opposition to a proposed settlement. Today, this court has before it my nine clients and over 20 other settlement appellants, virtually all of whom were seat owners of the Philadelphia Stock Exchange and whose seats on the Philex were exchanged just over 4 years ago for stock in the demutualized Philex. For most of them, the exchange is their life, their career, and for many, the seat represented their investment in the future. Many of these appellants continue to have working relationship with the exchange as brokers, traders, and others who have working arrangements with a self-regulatory organization such as the exchange. The vigor and intensity of the continued objections to this settlement has not been mollified by the recently announced decision of the exchange and its controlling shareholders, the six strategic investors who gained their control of the exchange, which is attacked in this action, to sell their interest in the exchange to NASDAQ for many multiples of their inadequate payment for almost 90% of the interest in the exchange. Indeed, the adamancy of the objections has only intensified given the now quantifiable loss to these long-term stockholders and former seat owners, and in which we believe is an insult to injury, the all-but-finalized and announced proposal to shift a great portion of the settlement proceeds to one of the stockholder objectors that is not before the court. And I believe Mr. Maimon covered the concern fairly well. Our appeal points this morning can be broken down into two categories, both of which I intend to discuss. First, it is our contention that the release sought by the appellees and granted by the court below was both procedurally improper and too broad in scope, granting to the appellees releases of claims which go beyond the bounds of this court's standard for a scope of release articulated in Nottingham Partners. Second, and more broadly, the court below failed to consider and then failed to set forth in specific findings mandated by this court for class actions that each of the requirements of the Court of Chancery Rule 23 had been met. Specifically, it is our contention that the court failed to revisit the issue of whether the class claims were typical of the class and whether the class representative and his counsel were capable of representing these interests without conflict. That failure is reversible error. Turning first to the issue of the release, it is our contention that the settlement seeks to release claims that were never part of this action, nor could have been. As of today, even though the complaint in this action has been amended, not one claim or cause of action is brought against the demutualization of the exchange.
That's really the nub of your argument, isn't it, that the inclusion of demutualization as a claim or set of claims to be released?
That is correct, Your Honor.
It is the fact, is it not, that the complaint does allege that the demutualization was procured by misleading representations and by other misconduct. Is that right?
I don't believe that it asserts any claim against the defendants with respect to that. Does it have some what I would call loose language there? Yes, Your Honor, but there is no
claim. Well, loose language to one side. There may not be a claim for relief, but there is an attack on the integrity of the process by which the demutualization took place. Isn't that correct?
I don't believe it would be you could characterize it as an attack. I believe it is a statement of I personally believe it's hyperbole as opposed to a direct challenge to.
Well, whether you personally believe it's hyperbole or not, there's a claim of some wrongdoing, whether or not relief is being sought. That's all I'm asking you.
Your Honor, I don't believe it is it is a fact of what they pled in it, but I do not believe that is a claim of wrongdoing that you could bring a claim on, Your Honor. That's the way I read their complaint.
Mr. Yes. Bella, here to your opening brief, you attached the memorandum opinion in Feinberg and Benton. How would that case in the federal district court be affected by this case we have?
Your Honor, I believe that if we are if this case is decided against us and the release is entered, that it would be used against the plaintiff in that case as a potential to release the claims and dismiss it.
Well, I mean, but is there a realistic argument to be made? It seems like that case is pretty removed from the facts in the case that's being settled here, you know, where an individual sells to another individual. The federal district court characterizes it as insider trading. So my question is, it realistic to assume that that insider trading case would be affected in any way by this settlement?
Your Honor, it is our contention that virtually all the cases that are outstanding relating to the Philadelphia Stock Exchange, including that one, will be attacked, and have, in fact, several of them have already had the release that has been granted in this case pled as a defense in that case. So it is our contention that if it hasn't, it will be, and we're here to ensure that all of our rights that we believe are that should be granted to us are granted here rather than in have to face it in the federal district court.
All right. Well, one of our underlying concerns in this case, obviously, is, you know, the Matsushita case, due process, settling claims, what gets extinguished. Due process, Justice Ginsburg's concurring opinion.
Yes. So
what I'd like you to just answer directly, because I don't want to take up your time with this, if you had to predict, you know, on a percentage basis, whether there's a realistic argument that the Feinberg-Benton case was extinguished by this proceeding, what would the likelihood be? Because, quite frankly, I don't see how it's affected.
Your Honor, I'm reluctant to put on the record here in this court a percentage or a position other than the fact that we believe that they will seek to release it. And if I said it's 1% chance or 50% chance, Your Honor, it's our contention that we shouldn't even be faced with a chance of it, because it this release is too broad.
Well, and that's the purpose of my question. You say it's too broad. You attach Feinberg versus Benton to your brief, and it would seem that you could tell the court unequivocally, this is so broad that it would even sweep in Feinberg versus Benton. And my question is, I don't see how that's possible.
Your Honor, we're concerned, and it's already been used against us, and we want to make sure that our position is protected as we go forward with the other lawsuits, Your Honor. As simple as that. And this is the best place to do that in this court, in first instance in the Chancery Court, and then here to protect that. And if we don't get the relief we seek, then we'll, again, protect our interest in the federal district court.
Mr. Vella, here,
yes.
Just to go back to demutualization for a moment, you know, whether or not you agree that that the complaint contains an attack on the demutualization, there is at the very least pejorative language that's attached to the description of it.
I'll agree that it's pejorative language. Yes, Your Honor.
And if the plaintiffs in whatever iteration of the complaint may have taken place had decided to seek relief against the demutualization, that is a claim that perhaps subject to timeliness defenses could have been raised. Isn't that correct?
Well, Your Honor, it might have been raised, and we don't dispute that it could have been raised. They don't raise it, Your Honor. And indeed, as Your Honors are well aware from Mr. Maimon's argument, the time at which the class is defined here is from April 20th, 2005, and that's at the time of the rejection of the Archipelago transaction, not a year and several months before, in January of 2004, which was when the demutualization actually occurred, when the shares were issued. And so we have a class and an action that is defined by what the operative facts, what Nottingham talks about, is being from the time that the claims that they are bringing took place, and that is in April 2005 rather than in January 2004. So they're not even attacking
No, all I asked you was whether the claim, had they chosen to make it, could have been raised, and you said that it could.
Sure, Your Honor. They could have repled this and brought some sort of complaint against the demutualization. I don't know what that would have been, Your Honor, but could they have done so? They could have. Their Section 220 demand never mentions demutualization. Their complaint used demutualization as a background fact, a precursor to the actual complaints, which they have the operative facts, which is what this court has looked at, the operative facts. That's the language that the court uses in Nottingham Partners. And those operative facts here are based upon the claims which they actually did bring, Your Honor, the ones that they pursued and the ones that they were seeking to obtain a judgment on, and those were related to the Archipelago deal and then the sales to the six strategic investors.
How would you define what is an operative fact for purposes of your argument? The Chancellor expressly found that the claims are being released in this settlement arise out of the common nucleus of operative facts asserted in this complaint. One definition, and this is a simple one from Black's Law Dictionary, is that an operative fact is a fact that affects an existing legal relation, especially a legal claim. What's your definition, or how should we apply that?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, and I talked about this in the first argument, that this court could have set a broader standard, but it chose operative facts. And in terms of what is an operative fact, I would say that they are the facts that are working on the transaction that is being attacked in the complaint, Your Honor. And what are those transactional facts? Well, they are involved only the Archipelago transaction, and then subsequently the sales of the six strategic investors.
So your argument is that they're transaction-based as opposed to relations.
Well, Your Honor, I think the easiest way to sort of articulate what is an operative fact here would be to say, can we remove from this complaint all the facts relating to the demutualization and still have an argument that can be made and a claim that can be brought on the claims which they did pursue? And you can do that. If you go through this complaint and excise out demutualization, you can still bring the claims that they brought. The fact that they mentioned demutualization, in my mind, is no more different than the fact that they mentioned the fact that this is the oldest stock exchange in the country. I mean, do we go all the way back to 1790 and wipe out all those claims as well? Well, no, you don't. Demutualization happened. It was a fact of how these individuals got their shares, but it was not a claim in which they attacked in this complaint. And I also want to take a moment here.
Is there authority for that definition that you just proposed?
No, Your Honor. I have not been able to find anything definitive about operative facts. The court here has articulated what that is, operative facts, and I have not seen anything else from this court to tell me what is an operative fact.
Operative fact, that language was used in the Nottingham Partners case.
Yes.
And basically in that case, what was really at issue there was whether a release as part of a settlement would be upheld where it was clear that what the parties were trying to do was also to release claims that were being asserted in a companion federal securities action. And the holding was that, yes, that release would be upheld because the claim in the securities action, the federal action, and in the Court of Chancery action arose out of the same set of operative facts, that is, the same core facts.
Exactly.
It's a different situation.
Your Honor. I apologize.
A little bit of a different situation than the one involved here, isn't it?
It is, but this is the case that sort of sets out what operative facts are with respect to a release. What can you release? And it has a different connotation with respect to that, what was being done in Nottingham Partners, I think it still plays to what is the scope of a release that this court will approve. And the court also talked about it being the gravamen of the complaint in the Dana action. And gravamen is what is it that, you know, is motivating, what is bringing to the fore the claims in that particular case, in both of those cases. Here, we're talking about what is the core, what is the operative facts that brought the matter to the claims that are being brought in this case. Is it?
One last question.
Sure.
Let's assume that we agree with you and that the language demutualization should be stricken from the release. And let's just suppose hypothetically that the case, the settlement goes forward on that basis, that is, without demutualization appearing in the release.
Yes.
Settlement is, you know, goes forward and whatever happens, happens. And then 2 weeks later, another lawsuit is filed in the Court of Chancery attacking the demutualization. Wouldn't there be a res judicata defense?
In this particular?
Yeah, if it were brought in the Delaware, the second Delaware action, which would attack the demutualization specifically.
Your Honor, I don't believe so because the complaint would have not. First of all, this complaint doesn't bring those claims. Second of all, the release doesn't release those claims. So why would there be? There wasn't any finding with respect to what demutualization
in Delaware,
was.
In Delaware, res judicata bars not only claims that were brought in the first action, but claims that could have been brought. And in an answer to my earlier question, you agreed that the demutualization attack claim could have been brought in this action. So my question is, if in a hypothetical second Delaware case, the demutualization claim would have been barred by res judicata, then why can't it be released?
Well, Your Honor, it's an interesting argument that you're posing there. If it could have been brought, and it's entitled to have been brought here in Delaware, doesn't mean that you release the claims that were already outstanding and were being litigated at that time. The fact that they didn't do that, Your Honor, is basically a position. You'll have to ask them when they come up on their opportunity. Your Honor, if I could make one point here, I know I'm getting into my time, but I
before
yes.
you do.
Yes, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Real quick question. Assuming you do not prevail on your arguments here, are you then opposed to the settlement as a whole, or are you supporting the settlement?
No, Your Honor, we completely oppose the settlement. And that was what I was attempting to argue next, which is the Rule 23. We've appeared to put the cart before the horse here, Your Honor, and allowed for a settlement that was approved as to the settlement, but without going back and looking at whether the Rule 23 requirements had been met. We believe the Prezant versus Sultan Maxim case, which was decided by this court, requires that in the first instance the court looks at the Rule 23 obligations. We raised those issues below. We made it clear in our argument before the Vice Chancellor that he needed to look at these arguments with respect to Rule 23. When he ruled on them at the end of our oral argument, he ruled on the fairness of the settlement. He never ruled on the Rule 23 provisions. We believe that the court should remand this to the Chancery Court for a finding of whether or not Rule 23, the prerequisites, were met.
Wasn't that covered in the order, the written order?
Your Honor, that's correct. He did do a written order, but he did not make findings on the records as this court in Prezant requires. It is absolutely specifically mandated on page 925 of that opinion from this court, is that whereas settlement is challenged and not complying with one of the Rule 23 requirements, the court of chancery shall articulate on the record its findings regarding the satisfaction of the Rule 23 criteria and supporting reasoning in order to facilitate possible appellate review. That was not done, Your Honor. The transcript makes it clear that it was not done, and we're asking for a remand to have that done, and then we'll see what the problem was in the first instance in the Chancery Court of why we believe that there's a conflict among the class, conflict among the class representative, and why you have such large number of objectors to this settlement. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. Lawrence Deutscheberger Montague on behalf of the plaintiff, Chuck Ginsburg, and the class. We're here because we've achieved an exceptional settlement in this case, which is valued at nearly $100 million. The principal components of this settlement include the return of 14% of the shares of the strategic investor defendants, as well as rescission of share rights of one defendant CEO, Mr. Fruscher, of 14%. In addition, there was a provision to inhibit future share dilution of Class A shareholders, and finally, $17.1 million added into the pot. The case was settled literally the day before trial via a mediation in front of Vice Chancellor Lamb. The settlement resolved the equitable claims of breach of fiduciary duty against the Philex board and the aiding and abetting by the six strategic investor defendants.
Let me interrupt you right there. In your view, does the release in this settlement also terminate the Feinberg case?
I think the questions raised by the court today indicate that I think that's an open question, which I think it's unlikely that would extinguish those rights. Although, as the Chancellor said, I think it's really a question for that court to consider in light of the final order issued by this Chancery Court.
But it's important for us to know your answer. You're defending the settlement. You're defending the scope of the settlement. And you should understand how it operates. So it would seem fair for us to have your view on whether this settlement that you're defending, what effect, if any, it has on Feinberg versus Benn. Does it extinguish that case or not?
In my view, I'm really not sure I can answer that at this point as we stand here. I think that one is a little more afield than some of the other cases that are perhaps in play due to the settlement in this case. I did want to also answer one question you raised about the res judicata effect of...
Well, no, but before we get to that, I don't understand why you can't answer it. In this case that you say is worth $100 million that the Chancellor says was fought, you know, tooth and tong, whatever his phrase was, what more information would you need to answer the question of whether Feinberg and Benton is effective?
Well, I'm not sure I'm familiar with all the details of that specific case. I know it's simply an insider trading.
The memorandum opinion was attached to Mr. Valahira's opening brief.
Well, I believe that the case likely would be dismissed under our release as well. However, again, it is a question of that court. And
you're saying this insider trading case involving third parties, I mean, what's being challenged here is the breadth of the settlement. And one of the suggestions by Mr. Valahira is it's so broad, it might even sweep in this insider trading case. I suggested in my question I didn't see how that was possible, and your answer seems to be that you do.
Well, again, in the context of that's not a case that's before me. I think it is somewhat afield from, the core of what we're releasing here, which included, the events of these transactions and the demutualization. Obviously, the trade between the seller and the buyer in the